Hello and welcome to episode 72 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, and Chris Weston.
Well, hello there, Matt, and welcome everybody to the latest episode of WB40 podcast. It's number 72, a number that seems portentous and important, but I can't figure out why.
A number of minutes since the last cabinet member resigned his or her position. There we go.
Well, we did have that on the group, didn't we? A counter since the last time there was a casualty in the British government, which does appear to be happening all at once. Couldn't have to nicer fellows, I would say.
No, absolutely. I'm thinking of resigning just because it seems to be the fashionable thing to do. Unfortunately, I don't actually have a job to resign from, which makes it slightly tricky for me.
There was a lovely Twitter exchange between a couple of the members of Parliament for the Conservative Party later on this evening. I don't know whether you've seen it. And it was somebody whose name I've already forgotten, who tweeted a rather grand statement saying that he was resigning as a permanent parliamentary secretary, PPS. Is that the right term? Anyway, he's resigned as a PPS. And then another Conservative MP tweeted back. He said, "You're only a PPS. Nobody gives a fuck." And I thought that's where we've reached at this point. It's all got to that point. And I suspect it's going to get worse as the day goes on, and as the week goes on, because they haven't actually released the bulk of this document, have they? This white paper that everybody's getting exercised about. They only released the summary, and Theresa May did a bit of exposition about it today. But everybody seems to be getting hot under the collar that it's something they can't possibly support. And they were going to release it on Thursday, but now they've changed that to it's going to happen next week. And next week, of course, is one of those splendidly elastic things that could mean just about anything. So the question is, I wonder why that's happened. And I know this isn't a politics podcast, but I can't help it. This stuff has dragged me into it today. That suggests to me that they're going, well, they might change it, because there are lots of threats that if they don't back down from it, there's just going to be carnage. People are going to be resigning left, right, and centre. So I wonder whether they're trying to judge now what could be in it and what can't, and they might pull a few bits, even though they've kind of stated that they're not going to change what was in the Chequers agreement, as it's called. It's all very febrile, isn't it?
Yeah, it's bonkers, I think, is technically the term. Who at the beginning of June would have thought you'd have probably got better odds on England lasting in the World Cup than Theresa May's government standing, which is where we seem to be at the moment. I watch as a sort of slow motion car crash involving an entire nation slowly happens, and it would be fascinating. And as a former student of political science, it would be a most interesting case study if it weren't for the fact it's all of our lives. But let's not try to dwell on that too much, because otherwise, you know. But the football going very well.
Yeah, indeed. I'd half expect to see Theresa May turn up in a waistcoat to the debates in order to try and summon some of that Southgate magic. He certainly seems to have everything going his way at the moment, doesn't he? And I have to say, I watched the quarterfinal. I'm sure lots of people did who listened to the podcast. I sat there, and I think I was a bit nervous for about, I don't know, 10 minutes in total. And that was probably periods of 2 minutes at a time. I like feeling utterly sick for most of the extra time in Colombia, and pretty sick for most of the second half, really, because I just got a sense that they were going to score. It just seemed to be such a easy game to watch.
Yeah, it was a fairly impressive performance, I think. So I don't know. We'll just wait and see what happens. I have to say, the thing for me out of this, though, trying to desperately steer it back onto some sort of technology thread, is VAR. And I don't know if you saw the Russia-Croatia game afterwards, but there was a clear penalty, an absolute clear penalty that even after VAR they didn't give, which I just hope this VAR thing doesn't get into mainstream regular football, because it is an enormous waste of time, because ultimately all it tells you is an awful lot of decisions in football are utterly subjective, and wasting time being more subjective about it really doesn't help. It's not like rugby where you've got clearly delineated things that can be pretty much said are true or not. Was there intent, or was it hand to ball or ball to hand? It's too subjective to be able to make any sensible judgments on. So let's get rid of the VAR. That's what I say.
So let's crack on with our returning feature, which is the yin and yang of the internet. You've got the yin this week, haven't you, Matt? And yours is, well, it's got internet in it. It's not entirely internet, but I think it's internet enough to fit into this feature.
Oh, it's all over the bloody internet. What I have decided to call brand wagoning. I'm sure somebody's probably coined that term before, but I made it up this evening. It's where you get consumer brands in particular jumping aboard particular waves of stuff that is going on to be able to hijack it to basically flog stuff. I think we're about to see an enormous amount of it, and it will be all a bit cryptic because they can't be seen to be in any way endorsing the World Cup unless they've paid FIFA an awful lot of money. But there will be crap loads of brands talking about all sorts of things about coming home over the next few days. And then if England go beyond the semi-finals, then this will hit a tsunami of brand garbage on the socials for the rest of the week. Saw it a bit at the weekend as well with the stuff around Pride, and there was something that was interesting. HSBC's had some really interesting stuff that was actually about the matter of gender and sexuality equality, and they did some really interesting little short films and stuff, and it's a bank, but you know, that's cool. But there was one particular, I can't think, it was a car company or something, and it's basically some just what was it, cars don't drive society forward, people do. And that was just the sort of thing that you could apply to just about anything, bit of a rainbow on the top. And it just is so annoying. And I just wish, particularly in that case, I just wish brands, if they're going to align themselves with something, to actually come out and really align themselves with something rather than trying to be able to put some wishy-washy feel-good gibberish sticking a bit of brand on it and a bit of contemporary stuff and hoping the world will think better of them as a result of it.
Yeah, it's pretty crass, isn't it? We do these... there are things that people seem to think that they should be in support of. It's one of the kind of if you were a member of the Conservative Party, you'd call it the politically correct brigade, where they say, well, it's Pride, so you've got to be seen to be in favour of that. It doesn't really matter whether you are or you aren't. And the old, that whole England thing, no doubt driven by a lot of patriotic fervour, but also it's fairly crass commercialism, isn't it? Let's pretend that we're all now in favour of the football. And next week, if it was cricket, it'd be cricket, and if it was rugby, it'd be rugby. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah, whatever is popular, basically. So anyway, that's marketing and the internet. So let's turn to more positive things. Let's turn to the yang for this week. It's something you picked up, and something to do with government corruption.
Yeah, my yang was very nearly today. We're going to get back to football again. The BBC, I don't know, if you watch the football on the BBC website and there's a live game going on, sometimes they'll have the game, they'll have the radio commentary, sometimes they'll have the pictures, the actual commentary, and then they'll have a text commentary going on underneath. Have you seen it? You know, the kind of live blogging type thing of the game. And 42 minutes, you know, yellow card, all that kind of thing, and then some comments from commentators. And this was they live streamed the semi-final from 1990, and then basically had the commentary running below it, with various comments that were being said by people at the time, like Trevor Brooking and whatnot on the TV. So that was quite nice. I had that in the background today, and that was very nearly my Yang. But actually, I'm going to go for the. It's a year old actually, but I'm going to go for it because I hadn't seen it before, and it's a story from Pakistan, and it's a story of political corruption. And the prime minister called Nawaz Sharif was essentially he resigned after he was disqualified from office. But the way it was done was through a document that was allegedly signed in 2006. And there's a picture of it on this webpage that we'll put on our website. And the document is signed and it's dated 2nd of February 2006. But the critical piece of evidence is that the document was written and printed out in Calibri, and the font Calibri was introduced in 2007. So this was the kind of smoking gun, really, that they'd used a font that hadn't existed when they signed the document. And that's a bit of investigative effort that deserves a round of applause and fits nicely into our technology-based program.
That's and fantastic.
And there is a fantastic jape that goes along with it, and that. This guy was called Nawaz Sharif, and then the people were saying on Twitter the day after that Pakistan was now San Sharif,
which is a work of punning genius.
If you're gonna have a font related issue, it's almost worth it just to have that joke, isn't it?
Oh no, absolutely. It sort of reminds me back in the day when you used to have typewriters and they used to be able to do the forensic footprint of of the typewriters, because the alignment of the different keys would be at different points, so you'd be able to have a unique where the characters came up. It's that kind of, you know, that's the sort of stuff with all this DNA and whatever. It's all a bit in the labs, isn't it? You want a bit more, you know, proper old sleuthing and
somebody dusting for dabs.
Absolutely. Anyway, fantastic. There we go, yin and yang. We'll put links to the Nawaz Sharif story on the webpage.
So, Matt, this week as well, we have an interview with our old friend Rachel Murphy, who's now of Be Different.
Yes, although she'd take umbrage at being called old. Rachel, I've known for a fair few years, former CIO in the health industry. She was at the National College of Midwifery, and then she went on to NHS Digital, where she did lots of good stuff over the last few years. I first got to know her when she was interim CIO at the National Archive, funnily enough. I was interested to go and find out what she was doing, because she, about 4 or 5 months ago, I guess, became chief exec of this company Different, and it's originally a recruitment company, but as you'll find out very early on in this, Rachel didn't really want to join a recruitment company.
I'm Rachel Murphy. I'm managing director of Different Group. And Different Group is an organisation who's been trading for the last 3 or 4 years predominantly as a recruitment company. And when the founder asked me to come in and join, I said I'm not fucking interested in a recruitment company. What I am interested in is, if you've got some cash in the bank, then I'll come and grow you a proper digital delivery company. So fast forward numerous conversations over a lengthy period of time. Steve and I have known each other for 10 years. I came in 8 months ago, and at that point it was very much a recruitment company. In essence, there's two parts of the company. One is around delivering digital outcomes, public or private sector. An example of those outcomes would be the work we're doing for the NHS at the minute, where we are fundamentally redesigning the NHS job service, so the end-to-end process, so anybody being recruited into the NHS, we're redesigning that service. And the other part of the business is around leaders. And the leaders business is about undertaking strategy reviews, having a look at operating models of organisations, public and private, not throwing a logo on a presentation, like a Big Five approach, but actually understanding what the business is, where it wants to go, and therefore the operating model that you're likely to need to achieve that. And doing some work with management teams around coaching and mentoring and bringing them up to speed. And a lot of the time that's not on the technical skills, it's on the softer stuff. So there's two distinct parts of the business. Leaders, we will launch early part of next year, and delivery is very much in train now. So 70% of our business is healthcare, and probably a further, 10-15% is government, and then we've got some private sector work we're doing as well. So quite a mixed bag. The company's changed a lot in the last 8 months. In the last 8 months, we've moved to a 30% permanent headcount, and we are growing rapidly. So we've grown £5.5 million worth of new business in the last 8 months, and now we're taking stock between now and Christmas with a view to, I guess, eating our own dog food, and we are putting in place an operating model that allows us to grow aggressively from next year. The intention will be continued growth in the UK and exploring international opportunities. So in a nutshell, that's what I'm doing.
Busy then.
Feet up, enjoying the sunshine, lounging around in a hammock, haven't put a shift in at all. Very relaxing, this startup. I'd recommend it to anybody.
Yeah. It's interesting that I think there are a number of people I know around at the moment who are looking at what has been the tradition of the recruitment market and the tradition of the consulting and systems integrator market, and basically looking at it and going, it doesn't work. The challenge is, actually I think often the challenge is, how do you get clients to understand that it doesn't work, even though they've probably abundantly got the evidence in front of them, because their methods of procurement and their methods of recruitment are all geared around those old models. Are you seeing a different approach coming from clients that you're working with?
I think clients are getting more savvy around who they're using to do work. So I'm delighted to see that government are not using as much Big Five. It is still kicking off. But I think they're starting to get more intelligent around what they actually need. So we've kind of carved out a bit of a niche around healthcare for possibly obvious reasons. And I think, having had that history in healthcare and in health regulation for the last 5 years, that lends itself to knowing, you know, we've got a bit of sector specific. The clients that we're talking to do know a lot more about digital and where they want to go than they have done previously. And I think that makes for a much more sensible conversation. A lot of the time, the work that we're doing, we have a co-located client and different team. We'll openly talk about Public Health England. We're leading the work for their digital exemplar around creating a digital collaboration environment. And we have almost as many people from different as we do from PHE. And the intention there is absolutely about delivering that outcome, but also cross-training and skinning up. And I think that's the move that is different. So the days of, whether it's government or private, saying come in and do, and then we'll buy a support contract, seem to start, you know, have started to change. By no means is it a done deal. You know, you only need to pick up a copy of Computer Weekly to see someone's let another £30 million deal. But it's starting to get there. That intelligent customer piece is starting to come to fruition.
It's that thing, actually, I've seen quite a lot of small consulting firms, which, to loosely generalise what you're doing, that the desire not to be c- to not have clients become dependent upon you, to build self-sufficiency in the client and to be able to provide services and expertise where it's needed on a short-term basis seems to be a principle that a lot of smaller organisations hold dear, and that is exact opposite, as far as I can see, the Big Five approach, which is absolutely about building dependency.
Yeah, I think that land and expand model's probably had its day. And the reality is, for small businesses, we haven't got the resources to land and expand. So for two reasons, that wouldn't work. For me, it's very important the culture of the business that we're growing is our culture, and absolutely we share and we work with other organisations, whether they're clients or they're partners. But what we're absolutely not wanting to do is to pitch up at a big department and, you know, start with 10 and find ourselves with 100. That's not how we're operating. We want to be held accountable for outcomes, and we want to be constantly challenged around the deliverables that we've committed to making for a client. And I don't think we're alone in that. So there are a number of small digital houses in this space, but they're all known quantities. So, you know, you've got Harry's DXW just opening up an office up in Leeds. Hippo recently done a partnership with Amedo. Vix Digital, we've just partnered with, doing the deal for Public Health England. So I think we've moved into a slightly different sphere where you've got vendors working together, and that will rival some of the larger consultancies, not in a land and expand, but in a capacity to do, and therefore drive a different way of working.
How far do you think the procurement models from public sector have caught up with this?
I think they are cutting edge, and we can learn a lot from them. In all seriousness, then they're not, but I do think that things have shifted dramatically. So the advent of DOS, G-Cloud 10's just come out. From a government perspective, it's streets ahead of where it used to be. Is it truly agile procurement? Almost certainly not. But the reality is, you know, the challenge we had between IT and digital in the last decade, we're now seeing that play out with other functions, and procurement is one of those. We did an event earlier this year where we talked a lot about agile procurement and brought in procurement people and brought in CIOs and CFOs across public and private. And the interesting thing there was a real desire and willingness to change, but not necessarily knowing how to. And I think digital teams sometimes can assume and expect that people are just going to rock up and learn their way. It doesn't work like that. You know, as an old school CIO, it didn't work that way when I made the transition from IT to digital. It takes time, and, you know, different people want to approach that in a slightly different way.
You mentioned about your experience in healthcare, and that's quite extensive over the last, 10 years, I guess.
Are you trying to age me, Matt?
No, I'd say 10 years is youthful. Everything in my world now is 25, which is terrifying. There's a lot of public debate at the moment about the challenges of healthcare. I'd turn that around a bit. What do you think there is about healthcare as an industry and digital within healthcare that other industries could learn? Because healthcare has to deal with a lot of significant challenges that do exist elsewhere, and many of those I think it meets.
So I think digital has disrupted industries over the last 10 years. You know, things have changed dramatically. How we engage as individuals has fundamentally shifted. I was using an example yesterday with a lady who I'm mentoring about a digital diary. And if you look at actually what you use, it's almost terrifying. Maybe that's just me. But we're constantly connected, and I think healthcare has made massive moves in the last couple of years. to drive innovation and to start to go out and talk to SMEs and understand the wider market and bring some of that thinking in. So people like Juliet Bauer, CDO for NHS England, you know, true innovators. They haven't picked up the old Gantt charts and said, you know, let's get rolling this waterfall program out. They've really upset the apple cart, and they've wanted to engage with you know, some of the big tech companies, the obvious candidates, Google, Apple, and start to join forces and work with these guys. This market is going to get disruptive, whether we like it or not. You know, GP at hand, I don't know really how much say and approval they had before they launched that product, but the fact that we've got technologies that can now enable people to access their medical record, book appointments, you know, keep a view on medicines, what they're taking, when. It can proactively remind, you can check blood sugars, you know, it's a different world. You know, as of yesterday, the NHS apps library has got 70 apps on there, and from memory, the most used being around mental health. You know, people want to self-care, and they want to be responsible and take ownership. And if you have a demographic who wants to get involved, then that shift is going to happen whether you're ready for it or not. And of course, you look at the NHS. Well, I looked at it before I went in, and I thought it was just one massive organisation. And then I realised it was just like a shoal of fish, and there's hundreds of them. And of course, there's complexity with that, and it's massive. And it's people's data and it's people's lives. And so, you know, rightly, there is rigorous security and controls around that. But I think some of the stuff that is happening in healthcare is exciting. And I think that it's, some of it is long overdue. But I also think it's not a quick fix. You can't click your fingers and say, open that up and make it happen. But what we can see are patients asking for more. I was in my GP surgery last night, and there was a couple of ladies registering from a different country. English wasn't their first language, but they were less than 2 minutes into the registration before they're asking for online access. And that, you know, that tells its own story. So I think... I think it's an exciting time for healthcare, and I think there's a lot of opportunity. I do think a lot of the thinking will come from different places. So whether that's startups, or it's SMEs, or it's kind of labs or environments where you know, there's been investment in companies, in the way that fintech has taken off, I think that healthcare is in that same space. There are the same opportunities.
It's interesting, the GP at hand service, which is your ability to be able to have a GP through mobile phone app doing Skype type consultations and so on, and actually they become your GP. I think it's a really interesting illustration also, though, of quite how deep these changes go, because I know a lot of GPs, traditional GPs, are really threatened by that, not because of digital delivery models, but because at the moment, GP surgery, which are private businesses for the most part, is dependent on a fee per signed up customer.
Yep.
And there's a balancing there, because most of your customers, young people like you and I, don't really put much pressure onto GP surgery. Older people...
The NHS may disagree with me, actually, Matt, but yeah,
well, okay,
in theory.
But older people obviously put more, and there's a balance in most GP surgeries that they're getting funding across the piece, no matter how much any individual patient uses the
yep.
service. The fear from GPs is that GP at hand is going to effectively cherry-pick relatively low-maintenance patients, younger, tech-savvy, digital people, which will leave GPs just with the really expensive to service ones. And putting aside the challenges of that, I think it's a really good illustration about how that that service digitally delivered is actually then putting pressure onto the very established funding models that exist for primary healthcare.
Yeah, and I think that that commissioning model needs an overhaul, and will ultimately need to be set in a different way. The reality is, whether it's driven centrally or locally by GP, you know, practice managers, digital has arrived. But you're absolutely right. At the minute, there is controversy around the GP at hand. You know, which way it is, who knows? But the reality is, people are going to want to consume services more and more in that way. Talking personally, I would rather be on the end of the phone for a lot of standard stuff than I would have to physically go in and see the GP. It's a real catch 22. So I guess, you know, things are afoot, things are changing, but to fundamentally reshape that is all the way back to the commissioning model. That's a big task, and I'm not saying don't tackle the big stuff, but it ain't going to be a 5-minute job.
No, absolutely. And I think the thing is that the digital stuff will quite quickly start to put pressure onto those things. It's not going to be things that are nicely on the surface. It's not a, you know, putting a new skin on the front of a website stuff. This is actually quite quickly going to get very deep into some of the profound challenges around how we fund and manage healthcare.
And I think you're right, you know, that lipstick on a pig is not the solution for this. And the complexity of health data from an interoperability standpoint, again, you know, that needs some proper working through to achieve that.
And other sectors that you're working in, are there particular areas that you're looking to focus on, or is it just a matter of sort of going adjacent to adjacent to adjacent?
So, I mean, healthcare is an obvious one because of the experience. I think we'd be pretty comfortable in pretty much any government setting, having spent a couple of years GDSing, and being very close to and familiar with the ways of working and the approach. I also, from a personal standpoint, I have a personal desire to do some work around the prison service, around Ministry of Justice. So there's an element of wanting to do, whether that work comes up and it's feasible and viable, I don't know. But as an organisation, I would like us to have a foot in both camps. And so, you know, the end point really would probably be a 60-40 in favour of public. It's very interesting working with a couple of private sector clients at the minute. You know, we talked about procurement a moment or two ago. You know, going through that process, I would have gone back to government procurement a million times over. You know, you make an assumption, it's so much easier, they can just buy, it's fast, but what you don't think about are all the standard T's and C's, the contracts, the variants, the schedules, and all of that that needs working through when they finally get their act together and agree what they're actually going to do. So I think the government, you know, government has an awful lot to be very proud of. In that space, I also think there are certain disciplines where we are placing our bets and hiring permanent. User research is one that's not prevalent right now in the private sector in the way that it is across government. I was talking to a potential banking client a couple of weeks ago, and they approached us because they wanted to take a user needs approach to an app that they're building. But that is not an all-day, everyday conversation. You know, I was delighted. So I think for us at the minute, it's absolutely healthcare, it's government, and the other organisations that we're working for are in the construction and professional services space. I think we, you know, we kind of look at these opportunities almost on a case by case. And if we think we can deliver well, we will do it. We've turned down a number of projects in the last 6 weeks because we are at the point right now where we can safely deliver the contractual obligations we have. But I want us to eat our own dog food, you know, implement our own operating model, and be really clear that January onwards is aggressive growth time, but I don't want us taking any risks with delivery. That's front and foremost how the company needs to operate.
And that scaling thing is that that's the next challenge, isn't it? Because it's being able to deliver at certain scale and then being able to continue to deliver quality whilst growing is something that I have seen. I've seen some organisations do extremely well. I knew CloudReach when they started going, and they've managed to be able to achieve that stupendously. There's a few organisations I've seen, though, that that's actually been a tipping point at which point they've collapsed.
Yep.
Your caution in being able to do that sounds very sensible.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not typically known for being cautious, but I think there's something quite interesting about having all that responsibility on your own shoulders. And I suspected this might be the case, but having always been an interim for 20 years, I've probably been more out there, more outspoken. And possibly more of a risk taker because of the parameters of control that were kind of imposed on me. It's going to make for a very interesting one in the next 12 months, seeing how that plays out. But I think it's absolutely imperative for me that the business that we grow is the business that I want to work for. You know, people are right at the heart of what we're doing. I don't want to knee-jerk and hire left, right and centre and hope that they're going to fit. If we're hiring permanent people in, we need to do it properly. Steve and I, the founder, both took a week off a couple of months ago when we hired a couple of grads so they could have a week with each of us. Now, of course, that's not a sustainable model going forward, but it's that sort of approach that I think we want to... we want to implement to get this right. So do I think there's sufficient business out there to grow exponentially? Absolutely there is. You know, we're very lucky in so much as I guess the Rachel brand has, you know, been known for delivery, and for that reason we're picking up business. But I'm super conscious that, you know, you get that stuff wrong and it doesn't continue to work. So it's important to me that I guess 20 years as an interim going in to fix environments that aren't working, and that's never about the tech, as you and I both know. It's 99% of the time about the people and the culture and the organisation that we do set ourselves up for success. So if it looks outwardly like we're treading a bit gently with some of the opportunities, it's because we want to do it right. And I would much rather turn something down than have to explain why it isn't working.
Well, thank you to Rachel for that. That's a really interesting insight into how that kind of business operates and how it can go through a transformation, which is pretty spectacular, really, in terms of the way his outlook. I think for me, though, one of the things that struck me was about the how you, as a small business, you make the decision to work with government or private sector, because it's quite hard to do both as a small business because of the ways of working. But Rachel at one point made quite a lot of play of the fact that they understood GDS, they understood the way those guys worked, they understood how that was being pushed into government. And whilst they do private sector work, I think that they can be two very different things, can't they?
They can. I'm not... I mean, the GDS thing is interesting because across government, and so across the millions of people who work across both central government, arm's length bodies, local authorities, the health service, and all the rest, and it's, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 million people who work in that sector, I guess. Probably even more than that. But the GDS thing, although maybe the brand is tarnishing a bit at the moment as events unfold, but you know, this is the way to do it, and this is the way forward, and this is the future, and lots of stuff around procurement and all the rest of it. I'm not entirely sure how well the GDS brand has travelled outside, although I think a lot of people in government think that it's got influence beyond, and I just don't know the answer. I think it's you know, the challenges of working in the public or private sector, fundamentally, I don't think are much different. I never have done. I've worked in both throughout my career. I don't have this view that, you know, private sector organisations are inherently effective and public sector organisations aren't, which is one that's held by a lot of people politically and is also one that's held by a lot of people, I think, in the private sector. There's a lot of bad stuff that goes on in both sectors. There's a lot of good stuff that goes on in both sectors. But there is definitely a different gearing, maybe. I think the conversation that with Rachel about the health industry is interesting. Over the years, if there's one thing that just about every industry will say, it's that we're different from every other industry. And the temptation, particularly if you're consulting, to just say, you know, everybody says that, is really strong. And you know that you need to be able to play to it a bit to be able to make people understand that you understand where they're different. And the answer is generally not very, you know, in not very many places. The one sector above all that I've worked in that I have seen that there is real call to say it is totally different from anything else is academia. And the health industry, although isn't academia, is heavily influenced by academia. And because of some of the things around multiple professional hierarchies and a whole bunch of things along those lines, and because of the levels of regulation, there are things about the health service that make it different. And so a public sector health service is an interesting combination and a real challenging one, I think. And I think, you know, there's lots to be learned from the health industry, because actually the health industry, although information technology isn't necessarily that hot within large parts of it, it's very, very, very good at adopting medical technology. If anything, it's too good at adopting medical technology, because it's medical technology that is one of the drivers of cost in the health service. But I think being able to, you know, understand all of that and to be able to appreciate all of that and optimise for that and to be able to sell into that and other sectors, unless you've got a really good diverse sales team, or you're good at making it up as you go along like I do, it is hard. It is really hard.
Yeah, I don't think, and certainly wasn't implying that public sector and private sector are inherently better or worse than each other. And that's, you know, I've worked in both as well, you know, or certainly alongside people from in public sector. And it's not about that really. It's what priorities are in public sector organisations compared to private. Public sector organisations can't ignore certain constituencies, if you like, in terms of usability and things like that, whereas in private sector you've got a bit more ability to do that. So I just think there are mindset differences that you need to be aware of in those two different areas. I also think in healthcare as well, again, mindsets are very, very different. And I've spoken to people in healthcare, and the idea that you prioritise on the basis of effectiveness is sometimes very hard to find. And that's not to say that people aren't doing their best, but it just being able to gather enough information to be able to make a simple decision, that's quite difficult. And I had I met up with a friend of mine this week who spends a lot of time in and around the health service with his daughter who's disabled. And you know, he's got hundreds of stories to tell about how, with a bit of thinking and a bit of insight, the technology could really help some of the areas they work with, because he's an engineer, you know, completely, you know, being a technology engineer all of his life. So he can see how this stuff could work, but it just never happens because of the difficulty in health of trying to get clinicians and management to work together and to see the same problem from the same angle. So yeah, it's a challenge. And you know, I think Rachel's one of those people who's uniquely placed to tackle it, isn't she?
Yes, because she is, I think, probably the most delivery-focused person I've ever met. I think, yeah, I think for them, it's about being able to find the right scale and being able to then scale within that. And that's the challenge I think any small organisation has, is how do you grow, and how do you grow in a way that is I mean, she talks a lot about aggressive growth. It's aggressive but sustainable, and not overstretching yourself and not taking too big a deal on so that you end up not being able to service it in the way that you need to and want to. So, all power to them. They, I think they're going to be doing some interesting stuff there over the next 12 to 18 months. So there we go, another one under the belt. Not quite sure why you say under the belt, but we'll go with it anyway. Week ahead, it does feel like the longest ever end to a school term for me, but we've got another 2 weeks of it, so by next week we'll be into the last week and looking holidays squarely in the face. But there's quite a lot of work to do between now and then. How's your week shaping up?
Yeah, it's going to be another quite warm week, although the weather appears to be tailing off towards the start of the school holidays. So, of course, another interesting week coming up, and I've got I'm backwards and forwards here and there, and it should be quite a productive one. And then next week I'm down in London again, so lots going on. Can't complain. But as you say, it's. We are approaching those long summer months where everybody goes on holiday and everything slows down, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, I'm hoping, because I could do with it this year. Looking forward to a bit of a break. But we've got a few more. I think we've probably got two more shows in between now and disappearing off for a bit. So hopefully got another interview next week. And we'll probably do, I don't know, a bit of a roundup the week after that, but always open to suggestion. Remember, you can join us, you can join the conversation on the WB40 WhatsApp group. To be able to do that, just get in touch with us on Twitter at WB40podcast, and we'll send you a link so that you can be a part of it and enjoy what is a really interesting set of conversations about all sorts of stuff. Some of it directly on subject, some of it slightly off, but all of it entertaining and very supportive, and it's a good group of people that are there, so join us. Anyway, until next week, bid you farewell.
Yes, thanks for listening. You can catch us, as always, at WB40podcast on Twitter, at our website at WB40podcast.com. And, of course, you can get us on Stitcher and iTunes and all good podcasting platforms.